And now coming up, a conversation about school assignments, some districts switching from race to family income in an attempt to achieve diversity even before the recent Supreme Court decision. But first, in a contentious news briefing today, White House spokesperson Tony Snow said that President Bush has not ruled out an eventual full pardon for former vice presidential aide Louis Scooter Libby, whose prison sentence was commuted by Bush yesterday. Snow said the president is leaving his options open, which brought many exchanges at today's briefing.
The president spent a lot of time and very careful deliberation about this
but
to try to get it right.
You would have got special handling because of who Mr. Libby is.
No, I think when you're trying to... No, it, what it's saying is he gets special handling because of the peculiar nature of the Libby case, which is it's ongoing and highly public.
So special handling because of who he is or what?
No, he got special handling because of the nature... Because... Look, here's what you're doing. What you're saying is because Scooter Libby...
And it went on. A jury found Libby guilty of lying to prosecutors trying to determine who leaked the name of covert CIA operative Valerie Plame and if it was in retaliation for her husband's criticism of the administration's use of intelligence in the run-up to the war in Iraq. The decision to commute his jail term came just hours after a federal appeals panel ruled that Libby would have to begin serving his sentence during the appeals process. Well, ABC political analyst Rick Klein has been following the story. Rick, a lot of tension in the questions today, but overnight some conservative bloggers were saying the president didn't go far enough with just waiving the jail sentence. So is this something where the president might have been trying to please many and now has perhaps not?
Well, I think if there was any political motivation in this, and of course you have to read some into it, it was that the president has very few people in his corner anymore, and those who are in his corner think that Scooter Libby was really the fall guy in this whole scenario and the victim of a rogue prosecutor. So, yeah, there's a lot of criticism that he didn't go far enough, but I think there'd be even more outrage and more anger on the other side of the aisle if he had gone for a full pardon. As it is, the felony conviction does stay on his record. He has to pay a $250,000 fine. He does remain on probation, although he won't spend a day in jail.
What's the debate today? What are both sides saying as to yesterday's waiving of the jail term?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, when we look at the presidential candidates, the Democrats, to a man and a woman, are saying this is a travesty of justice, and the Republicans down the line are saying, good, this is the right way to handle it. It was an unjust sentence for an underlying crime that didn't even exist. The prosecutor never found an underlying crime of the leak. So clearly both sides see different political calculations at work here. This won't be the last we hear of it. I guarantee that many members of Congress are going to have questions about this when they come back after the 4th of July recess, and we'll be using this as another data point in the argument that they've been making about the president's use of executive power.
Republicans also complaining that Sandy Berger, who was national security advisor in the Clinton administration, got no jail time for illegally sneaking some classified documents out of the National Archives. But then Democrats coming back, and reporters were bringing up today the fact that there are 3,000 convicted criminals in the U.S. now waiting for decisions on requests for commutation. So the debate goes on. Is it thought, though, that there might be some sort of investigation down the road?
Yeah, there's some buzz on Capitol Hill. I mean, no one's actually on Capitol Hill today, but some of the staff members are saying that they'll be exploring some investigations. There is nothing that Congress can do to reinstate the sentence. The president has the constitutional power to commute, to issue pardons, and that is irrevocable. However, there are a lot of questions that members of Congress can ask. They can haul in members of the administration, or try to anyway, and ask about how this was handled and whether this went through the normal review process or got some kind of special handling because of who Scooter Libby is. Those are all questions that you pretty much guarantee Democrats are going to want to get answered.
And Rick, most well-known pardons, when the first President Bush pardoned Caspar Weinberger, who had been implicated in the Iran-Contra affair, President Ford's famous pardon of President Nixon, these came at the end of presidential terms, this one with a year and a half left, but it was sort of forced by the decision of the court that Libby would have to serve some jail time.
That's right. I think if the judges had allowed him to remain free pending his appeals, then we wouldn't have seen this pardon until the 11th hour of the administration, if at all, although I think now it does become likely that there would have been some action. And the president made that point, that what's different now is that actually he's going to have to start spending time in prison, probably in the next week or two, if this move had not been taken. So, yes, the timeline was pushed up. It was not lost on a lot of people. This came down late in the day on the week of 4th of July. But the timing, of course, is the president's full discretion. He has
and it did didn't go on, and it didn't go unnoticed.
That's right.
Rick Klein, political analyst for ABC News. Rick, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Well, it is summer vacation time, but school officials are at work after last week's Supreme Court decision striking down the voluntary use of race to integrate schools. Many school districts are eyeing programs already in place that have replaced race with family income as a factor and a way of achieving diversity. In a few minutes, we're going to have a conversation with the former superintendent of schools in La Crosse, Wisconsin, the first school district in the country to use income-based assignments. But first, for an overview, we turn to New York Times National Education Reporter Tamar Lewin. Tamar, welcome.
Thank you.
Can you tell us, first of all, these schools that are considering a program to achieve diversity, about how many are there and why are they doing it?
Well, no one really knows how many they are because there's no mandate about this. It's just something that school districts do if they think it's something that will work in their district. And, of course, there's lots of districts that don't have either enough middle-class kids or enough white kids to really be thinking along these lines, if you think of New York City, for example. It also works better if it's a big district that has both a city and a county, like Wake County in North Carolina, which is Raleigh, and all the surrounding districts, where you have a real possible mix of kids.
Well, in fact, let's talk about that county. At first, I want to mention, though, that it was our understanding that here in Massachusetts, Lynn, Massachusetts, was using race to achieve diversity in part to get state funds under the State Imbalance Act.
Massachusetts is going to be one of the hot spots of this because racial balance, of course, is the word that the Supreme Court likes least. So that's not something we will be talking about much more. That's what drives them crazy constitutionally. But in Massachusetts, there is the Racial Imbalance Act, and it provided financial incentives for schools that did a lot to diversify. So something around 20 districts had voluntary integration plans, and Lynn is the one that got tested in the courts most. And what they did, and the way you sell any of these plans, is school parents want their kids to go to the best school. So the sort of carrot here is always you're going to get more school choice. And in Lynn, what they did was they said any kid can go to his or her neighborhood school. But if you want to go to a school that's not your neighborhood school, you can only do so if you're not going to increase the racial dominance there. So if you're a white kid and you want to transfer to a school that's already mostly white,
Right.
But if you're a black kid and you want to transfer into that same school, that's fine, and vice versa.
What are some of the other ways that schools across the country have been using race to diversify?
Well, the big thing when people thought busing was not working so well and was so unpopular with parents was magnet schools. And that's still perfectly allowed. And that is, you say, you know, we're going to just lure people into schools out of their neighborhoods by making this one really fabulous at art or that one really fabulous at science. And assume that parents are going to find a school that feels right for their kid wherever it is. Those kind of big, broad, social engineering that doesn't put a kid in a category by race as an individual, those are still fine. So you can put your school wherever you want, and you can do that with an eye to being on the boundary of a black neighborhood and a white neighborhood. You can draw your school attendance zones in a way that's going to get a mix of kids. What you can't do is say, this kid over here is black, and therefore he or she must do this.
We've got two spots left at this magnet school. We need balance, so we can only take two black children or two white children.
Exactly. Or in Seattle, where they used race as the tiebreaker at the most popular high schools.
You write that this decision by the Supreme Court is going to lead to more litigation rather than less as some of these programs get tested. It's already led to a lot of confusion. But in part because of that, it's led to people eyeing, as we said, these socioeconomic programs as another alternative. You were talking about North Carolina. What kind of programs do they use to achieve the kind of diversity they want?
Well, they used to have a pretty typical voluntary integration program that said we want our schools to be each school within this percentage and that percentage. Legally, that's always been iffy. And when their circuit court looked like that wasn't good, they said, okay, we're going to switch to a different kind of integration because really what is the problem for kids in schools is being in a high concentration of poverty school, whatever the race. And if you were mixing very poor black and very poor white kids, that doesn't do anybody much good either. So what we want is to have enough middle-class kids in the school so that there's going to be middle-class parents involved, and that the poor kids are going to be mixed in with a lot of kids who have, you know, parents who are doing reading to them very early on and have big vocabularies. And the way they decided to do that, and this is sort of interesting, they didn't ask family income. They said, we're going to look at neighborhoods and figure out what percentage of kids in that neighborhood are eligible for free or reduced lunch programs, which is kind of a good proxy for family income. And then we're going to say, in that same way that we used to with race, we want our schools to have no more than 40% of the kids in the school being eligible for free or reduced lunch. So it was the same kind of numeric target, but just on a different basis. And they've done well.
I was just going to ask, when you say they've done well, how do they measure that?
Well, by student achievement, it's gone up.
Well, we read the superintendent in Cambridge, Massachusetts, which also has an income-based program, saying it doesn't necessarily prevent racial or ethnic segregation in some cases, and that there was disappointment with the court ruling because of that. Are you hearing about places where income-based assignments, you know, don't work?
It's very small so far. In Cambridge, for example, which has been touted as one of the programs that has been doing this for a while, it's hardly begun. I think they're adding a year each year, and maybe they have kindergarten, first grade, and second grade, at which point you're not thinking too much about student achievement. This is still very early days for this economic integration idea. Wake County is really the only big one that has a mixed area and is a big school district and has been going on for a while. And as I said, it just can't work everywhere, because in most urban districts, there's been such flight from the public schools by the middle-class parents that there aren't enough left to make it work.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, Tamar, isn't that one of the problems, what you just mentioned, that no amount of busing is going to change a district that doesn't have enough students to choose from, of different backgrounds, yeah.
And if you're in that kind of situation, and you see that your kids are just really not doing as well as they ought to, in many districts what you turn to instead is some push for more money for the schools.
Well, you quote educators as saying that race mixing is already an antiquated issue for them, that this is Chester Finn, president of the Thomas Fordham Institute. He says parents in poor schools are pushing for more money for their school. They're suing and often winning in court.
Now, yeah, black parents and white parents alike are going to say at this point, you know, integration's a really nice idea, but it's secondary in my mind. What I care about is having a very good school for my kid. And if it turns out that it's an all-black school, I can live with that. I'd love to have diversity, but that's not the top priority.
Tamar Lewin is New York Times national education reporter, speaking to us on some of the aspects of the aftermath of the Supreme Court decision. Tamar, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And just ahead, what happened in La Crosse, Wisconsin, when they switched to family income as a factor in achieving diversity, and as they said, to get a better education for kids? And later, why aren't you on vacation this week? A life coach says, go away. Back after the break, here and now. Now, and we're back with our look at schools using family income as a factor to achieve diversity. La Crosse, Wisconsin was the first district to do so in 1992, and although its architects feel the program has been somewhat watered down, it's still in place. Richard Swantz was superintendent of schools when it was adopted, and Dick, describe the program and also what motivated you to adopt it.
Essentially, what the program did was recognize the fact that having high percentages of children from poor families in certain schools was not a very good idea, that it brought special kinds of demands to everybody, particularly the teachers. So as we began to consider building two new schools, the teachers began to speak to several of us about the fact that as long as we were going to be redistributing children, because, you know, when you open up two new schools, you really do have to redistribute children, why not take that into account?
Well, I think I was just reading you at one point. There was a sort of a gut feeling, too, that something was just wrong. There was an inequity.
Well, yeah, and if you just take the guy at the arterial bar where I used to go periodically to check things out and say, hey, for what it's worth, we've got schools that have 10% of the children going to them living in poverty, and we have schools with 90%. And we'd like to sort of move that around a little bit and not have that many poor children attend one school. And as long as we're going to be changing boundaries anyway, that's something we think we might want to address. And you know, to a person, they'd look at you and say, well, it makes a hell of a lot of sense to me. What it boils down to, of course, is when it comes to your child.
Right. And if your child's the one who has to travel on a bus.
You got it. We had very open discussions about it. I personally sent a letter to every parent in the district telling them what was going on with this, and that when we recast these boundaries, one of the things we were going to be looking at was the issue of poverty. But when a map was published after the board approved the new school district boundaries, if you will, we had real controversy.
In fact, there was a recall school board that was created in a special recall election that opposed the plan.
That's right.
And they actually added a clause where parents could opt out of this.
Yes, they did.
Yeah. And what happened?
Well, some parents did. Many did not. Most of the parents were, you know, as much as they weren't too crazy about the move for their child from school X to school Y, now that their child was at school Y, they weren't too crazy about moving him or her again. And quite frankly, they were finding out that their child liked school Y. It wasn't the horrific experience that maybe some people thought it was going to be. Because the preponderance of children going to any one school would still be middle-class children. There were some, quite frankly, that were so upset with us, they left the public school system and enrolled their kids in private school.
As the experiment, and it really was, as the experiment went on, how was it viewed?
It was viewed fairly positively because even the evidence politically, if you mentioned this recall, there were 9 board members and 8 of them were turned over. And so I was dealing with a board that, quite frankly, disapproved the plan and was not very excited about the architect
of
the plan.
This is the new recall board. In other words, they replaced 8 people. So you had
right.
suddenly 8 new people on a board who didn't
right.
like your plan.
Right. But when they stood for election again, which in some cases was just in a year, every one of them was defeated.
Right.
So I think the community maybe got its breath a little bit. I mean, it was very divisive, and I felt badly about that. It really tore the community apart in many ways. But I think, you know, time, emotions, and so forth settle down, and folks find out it's not anywhere near where we thought it was going to be.
But for those who stayed, we're reading a report in the La Crosse Tribune, the La Crosse, Wisconsin newspaper, that takes a look back at this time.
Mm-hmm.
And people are remarkably positive in general about it. Teachers talk about having kids from poor schools who didn't know what an umbrella was, they'd never heard of it, put together with kids who maybe had 10 umbrellas at home. What were some of the benefits that teachers told you of having this sort of integrated middle-class backgrounds and language skills?
The teachers would say that they had more time to teach mathematics. They weren't spending as much time dealing with other matters, many of them being social needs and the like. They felt that they could pair up students, and there would be great learning activities, not just from the standpoint of mathematics, but from the standpoint of getting to know other ways of living. I mean, some of these kids were coming from schools where, quite frankly, the principal would tell me you walk through the playground and on a Monday, and the topic of conversation universally almost was whose relative went to jail.
Well, one teacher is quoted today as saying having the kids come from the more middle-class school with, as you said, different backgrounds, language skills, was like I died and gone to heaven because
yeah.
it could branch out the teaching. And a student is quoted as saying that she brought clothing and toys in to donate to the school store and then watched as her fellow students bought her items, and it gave her compassion. So there's those kinds of anecdotal stories. But was there any measurable success?
We never said we were doing this, quite frankly, to improve test scores. But we did watch it. And what we found is that in schools that had an influence of middle-class students into their buildings, those scores did go up. Whereas schools that received some of the children from poor schools, those scores did not go down.
Again, this La Crosse Tribune article is very enlightening, but there's also sort of a reader response section to it where people are writing in about their experiences. They were students at the time in the early 90s when this happened. Most of them have very positive memories of being in the school, but a couple of things jump out. One is that while they made lifelong friendships within their own economic group, because they were bused together in many cases.
Yeah.
There was very little friendship making across economic lines because they couldn't go home and play with each other. Do you worry about that?
That's a fact, and that's why really the in my estimation, the best way to have this occur is to have more integrated neighborhoods so that the children do live together and go to school together. I know that that sounds a little Pollyannish, but quite frankly, it's something that can be done if we made it a priority. I mean, I don't have an answer to all of this. All I know is that, in all honesty, the issue is poverty, in my opinion. It's not race. Race in this country, unfortunately, tends to follow poverty for all kinds of reasons that we need to get into. But children are having trouble performing in school because of the poverty they live in, not the color of their skin. I firmly believe that.
That's Richard Swantz, former superintendent of schools for La Crosse, Wisconsin. Well, tomorrow on Here and Now, a fascinating look at the importance of borders in American history, how even in the Wild West, Americans wanted the government to give them some boundaries. And still ahead, with the candidates, what are they eating on the campaign trail in Iowa? After the news, Here and Now.
Support for Here and Now.
And now, according to a recent study from the Hudson Highland Group, a professional recruitment firm, 56% of American workers do not use all their vacation time, and further, not using that time might make them less productive workers, may even affect their health. Of course, some people, some parents come to mind, don't ever get a break. But why don't those who can get a break from work take it? Joe Robinson is a work-life balance coach and founder of the Work to Live, and he joins us on the phone from Santa Monica, California. Joe, take us a little deeper into the research for those who aren't convinced that vacations are important.
Well, vacations are as important to your health as watching your cholesterol or getting exercise. Just an annual vacation can cut the risk of heart attack in men by 32%. And in women by 50%. So that's a pretty good benefit of taking a vacation right there.
You've got my interest. But give us more stats.
Well, beyond that, vacations have been shown to cure burnout, which is the last stage of chronic stress. Mm. It's very difficult to shake. You get in a cycle you can't get out of. And vacations have the ability, because they help us wind down, to regather crashed emotional resources.
No, wait a minute. You just spoke of burnout in a clinical way. Is there? I mean, is that really?
It is a clinical thing. We bandy about a lot of these terms, stress and burnout, to the point where they become kind of meaningless, mainly because I guess it's everywhere. But these are actually real things that seriously impact our bodies, the people around us, and our bank accounts, because stress is 5 times more costly to treat than the average workplace malady, and things like depression, which is another symptom of work without end and having no impact on your work, is even more expensive than that to treat.
Well, the Families and Work Institute did a study, and they said that vacation deprivation is one reason workers are reporting more mistakes, anger, and resentment at coworkers. Former NASA scientists working for Air New Zealand used to test some testing tools and found that vacationers experience an 82% increase in job performance when they come back.
There's no question about it. There are a number of surveys that show that when you take a vacation, your performance increases when you come back. And it's, not rocket science to try to figure out what takes place there. When we take a break, our brains get a chance to get that stressor interrupted and get a chance to get recharged, regenerated. We can feel that just from a night's sleep. Vacations have a very similar effect on us. And when we don't take them, the pent-up stress and adrenaline flowing through our body, all that stuff, ultimately has a big whammy on us, in terms of our health, but also our productivity. That's the thing that people don't realize, how important it is to step back for our performance. We're in the knowledge economy right now, right? So it's what's going on in your brain that is the most important. I've talked to sleep doctors who tell me that the brain goes down way before the body. We think that because we're not in the factory anymore, and most of us are not taxing our bodies that much, we're just sitting on our butts, that we can go all day and night. But it's just the opposite. Brains shut down after a while, and typical productivity per day is about 5 to 6.5 hours, and after that, our mind is kind of spinning around in circles.
Huh. So we've already said that half of American workers who were part of the study said they didn't take any. So that was my cell phone.
Oh.
And that's one of the reasons I'm understanding that people aren't taking their vacations. We're sort of tied to our electronics.
Yeah, technology is really causing people to have a harder time than usual to break away from work. It's a very complicated issue. We're tied up with work in our identities. We create the self through labor in this country. So we already have that going against us where we don't value stepping back. We think only production has value. But then on top of it now, we have all of the tools of technology that are dogging us day and night, and it becomes a compulsion after a while, an addiction that we can't step away from the connection because we've gotten so used to peering into that screen to see who's contacting us or what's up. And so people have a real hard time pulling away from that now. But,
well, or they take it with them. And we're understanding that that the Sheraton in Chicago is offering workers with BlackBerries a sort of a detox program where you can hand in your cell phone that they'll lock up in the hotel vault. I'm reading in Business Week that more than 1,000 people have written to thank the hotel for that. And that taking vacation is particularly hard for what writer Sylvia Ann Hewlett calls the professional class panjandrums. These are apparently the Uber workers, extreme job holders, who are sometimes afraid that if they leave, people will notice that everything went okay without them.
Yeah, that's definitely something I hear a lot from people who have what I call the center of the universe syndrome, where they feel that everything is being held together simply by them, being there in their chair like a statue 24 hours a day. But it's really an illusion, and I talked to one woman who felt that way for many years. She was finally, I guess, forced to take a vacation. She came back after 3 weeks, and she wondered why she hadn't done it 10 years earlier. So it's just a construct that we have in our mind where we build ourselves up because, again, work is so important. It's our only identity. So we need to create an identity outside of the job so that we can move in the direction of life and vacations.
Right. Some people think that they are doing that by taking these mini vacations, extended weekends. Does that do the same thing?
You don't get the same recuperative benefits. Clearly, any time you can get for recharging and rewinding is great, even if it's a long weekend, which is now the standard American vacation, by the way. It's not even a week anymore. But to get real recuperative benefits, you need to have some real time and some time that is not interrupted by checking email or any of the stressors of the office. 2 weeks is what it took for burnout to be cured on some of the studies that measured that impact from vacation.
It would seem that some companies are picking up on how this is good for the bottom line. We're reading that PricewaterhouseCoopers tracks employees who haven't taken their vacation time and reminds them, you got to get away. And then listen to this. Intel, all full-time employees who've been there for more than 7 years get 2 consecutive months of paid time off on top of their vacation. And Netflix, we're reading again in Business Week, doesn't even have vacation time. They just tell their workers, go when you can. Now, that's one part of the work world. But a lot of the work world is still punching the clock. People can't take that much vacation.
Well, it's actually a very serious situation right now. We've seen massive erosion of vacation benefits in recent years. And, it's due to the same forces that are making pensions go away and other benefits. Companies are concluding that they can get away without letting their people take vacations. So we have more and more people. A third of all American women these days don't get any paid leave, mm-hmm. A quarter of men. And that protection is vanishing. So that's one of the things that myself and my group Work to Live, we've teamed together with another group called Take Back Your Time, which is fighting against time poverty in this country. And we've just released a draft proposal for a minimum paid leave law in this country, 3 weeks for anybody who's worked at a job for a year.
Joe Robinson, work life coach, speaker, trainer. You're also author of Work to Live, The Guide to Getting a Life. You can find out more about Joe and his work at our website, here-now.org. Joe, thanks so much.
Nice to be here.
Of course, some of us still just want to feel that we're needed. A heads up before we go today, a brief reminder of what was lost when Beverly Sills died last night. You're listening to Here and Now. Iowa is the place to celebrate Independence Day if you're running for president. Several candidates are on the hustings there, including Democratic Senators Barack Obama, Christopher Dodd, and Joe Biden, and Republican Mitt Romney. Also, Senator Hillary Clinton. She's behind in the polls in Iowa, but last night she unveiled what is either her campaign's greatest asset or liability, former President Bill Clinton. The two had their first joint campaign appearance at the Iowa State Fair. Richard Wolff, senior White House correspondent for Newsweek, was there, although today he's on the Barack Obama bus heading for southeast Iowa. Richard, there was a lot of anticipation going into last night. How did the Clintons do?
Well, there was a lot of anticipation, a lot of excitement, a lot of media, of course, and a reasonable crowd for Iowa, 3,000 or so people there, not as big as some of the Barack Obama events. But, you know, the real question for us in our minds was, were people there for him or for her? And there's no question he was a big draw. I have to say, from what I saw, people were more interested in him.
Well, now this has been the big question. If standing side by side, she could appear as presidential, as appealing as her husband. Your thoughts?
The thing is that there is this big contrast between their speaking styles and really between the characters of these two people. Just before he introduced her, he told a story about how he had been recently playing golf with some friends and had just teed off on the first green, and one of the caddies who was there stopped him and said, "You don't know me, and I don't normally do this for a living, but I'm actually a firefighter from New York, and I just want to tell you something, that your wife was one of the first to understand that some of us would get sick from what we did on that terrible day," meaning 9/11, and some of us would die. And while Bill Clinton was telling this story, his eyes seemed to moisten and he was wagging his finger at the crowd. And it was a dramatic story and a fabulous introduction to his wife. His wife then picks up the microphone and everyone's very jazzed up and moved. And she launches into how she's at the Iowa State Fairgrounds and how she loves being at fairgrounds. And she has visited fairgrounds before in Arkansas. She had none of the drama, the impact, the emotion, and the connection, I think, that her husband clearly brings so effortlessly to the stage. There were moments when I could hear the cicadas chirping and the birds singing. And I have to say, look, I noticed a trickle of people leaving as she was speaking, and it turned into a stream well before she finished.
Moving on, looking into the future, this was supposed to be the big new, you know, plan of the two Clintons campaigning together. Do you think it's going to continue?
Look, I spent most of the time looking at Bill Clinton's face on stage, and let's just say his face was drained of color and he looked like he hated the whole thing. I suspect that they won't be doing this too often. Mm. This is the kind of thing that, for the Clinton campaign, you want to get out of the way.
Well,
do it early, stop people asking the question, where is he, and then move on, because in the end, people have to vote for her and not for him.
Well, Hillary Clinton is trailing John Edwards in the Iowa polls, and in some, she's running third behind Barack Obama. But, you know, we know it's kind of topsy-turvy in Iowa. Mitt Romney is, you know, tops the polls there on occasion, and he doesn't do so nationwide. And he, of course, with the Republican side. Why is Iowa so hard for Clinton?
Well, the short answer is that Iowa rewards people who spend their time here in small crowds. Iowa also rewards people who are on TV, and Mitt Romney is on TV. The problem at this stage is that if you look at most of these polls, at least the one-fourth of respondents say they haven't made up their mind. People in Iowa make up their minds late, so I would put a strong note of caution on anything you read into the polls right now.
Richard Wolff, what's the strangest thing you expect to see a candidate eat over the next couple of days?
Pure butter. you know, they have to eat a vast amount of pancakes, of course. We're not quite in pancake flipping season, but that's always a perilous moment. I don't know if you remember Gary Bauer in 2000 flipping a pancake. I think it was in New Hampshire and he fell off the stage.
Right.
You never know when you mix food with candidates what can happen.
Right, or with fairs, because you are definitely in fried Twinkie territory.
Everything on a stick. I've noticed Iowa likes putting things on a stick. These candidates are going to have to at least do some working out afterwards.
Richard Wolff, senior White House correspondent for Newsweek, on the Barack Obama campaign bus in Iowa. Richard, thanks so much.
Anytime.
Up next, she plays the mum of Harry Potter's best mate, actress Julie Walters. After a break, here and now.
Bye.
It's Here and Now. Two-time Oscar nominee Julie Walters starred as Rita in the 1983 film Educating Rita and as the tough but caring dance teacher in Billy Elliot. But perhaps the British actress is best known as Ron Weasley's mother in the Harry Potter films, a role she'll be reprising in this summer's hugely anticipated Harry Potter and the Order of the Phoenix. Walters also teamed up with the actor who plays Ron Weasley, Rupert Grint, for the film Driving Lessons. Grint plays Ben Marshall, the repressed son of an English vicar and his overbearing wife. Ben's summer vacation is filled with strict Bible study, but he has the soul of a poet, which begins to flower when he responds to a job posting from Evie, an eccentric actress played by Julie Walters.
I pay £6 an hour, which is a pound more than McDonald's. So if that is unsatisfactory, I suggest you go and work for them. How you can consider such a thing in all good conscience, I really don't know.
From that somewhat inauspicious beginning, Ben works for Evie and ultimately forms a Harold and Maude-like friendship. The film is out on DVD today. When it first came out, we spoke with Julie Walters and noted that she played a student in Educating Rita and now plays a mentor in Driving Lessons.
They kind of mentor one another in this, because sometimes Evie is more the child in the situation than Ben is. Do you know what I mean? I feel it's a mutual thing. But I know what you mean. It is kind of full circle, because I suppose you could say that with Educating Rita as well, that they mentor one another.
Well, and that circle is drawn by the writer and director of Driving Lessons, Jeremy Brock, who also joins us in the studio. And Jeremy, I know you'd been working on this screenplay for 5 years. And it was based on something from your childhood. What was that?
It was based on a friendship that I formed with Dame Peggy Ashcroft, a famous, iconic English actress, before she died. I was that dysfunctional vicar's son living in that suburban world, and I needed to break out. I got a job cleaning for her, and the friendship that we forged formed the basis of the friendship between Ben and Evie.
You know, you talk about the dysfunctional family. We hear it sort of muffled behind the walls, but yeah. We hear what's going on. And at one point, the mother of this young Ben comes in and leans over him. And I wrote it down. She says, "Whatever happens behind these walls, we're God's ambassadors. We show the world a smile on our face."
Mm-hmm.
Is that your childhood?
That is partly how I experienced it, yes. I came from a controlled background. My mother, bless her, was very evangelical, and I was very constricted by that and wanted to break out, rather as Ben does.
And into Ben's life comes Evie, played by you, Julie Walters. How fun was this character?
Oh, every sort of fun. First of all, she's an actress, which is it's fantastic to play that, because you can play all the vulnerability and everything that an actor's got with it, but not have to suffer it too much yourself at the same time. But also, she runs the gamut of just about everything. She has no front. So you'd get to play her fragility and her strength. She just sort of skids from one thing to another. It's just fantastic.
And she loves the theatre. And the character is someone who, you know, breathes Shakespeare, but is best known for playing a role in a soap opera. What's the line? What's her famous line in the soap opera?
I'm a woman, Leland, not an oil tanker.
Have you been in that position also to be known as, oh, you're the one on the hand commercial? Or
oh, yeah. I can remember that, walking along the street and a boy saying, "You're that woman from the tea advert," and being absolute, I was younger then, I was really hurt by it. I wouldn't be now, I'd quite understand it. But then I was. Excuse me, I have played at the National Theatre on stage, how dare you?
But with Ben, with this young man that comes into your character's life, you get to live what you love, which is Shakespeare. Mm. Let's listen to a scene where they both just start performing Shakespeare scenes, including Coriolanus, A Midsummer Night's Dream, Othello. Let's listen.
Ill met by moonlight, proud Titania.
What jealous Oberon! Fairy, skip hence. I have forsworn his bed and company.
Tarry, rash wanton. Am I not thy lord?
I must be thy lady.
Kill me tomorrow. Let me live tonight.
Nay, and you strive.
But half an hour.
Being done, there is no pause.
But while I say one prayer,
'tis too late.
Julie Walters, I'm imagining there are very few opportunities to have a scene like that in modern film.
Oh, yeah. I mean, this part is completely unique. It just that parts for women my age are, you know, scarce on the ground anyway. But parts like this, are just, well, because she is a, you don't meet many people like Evie, but they do exist.
Well, and then there's Ben, again played by Rupert Grint, as we said, probably best known as your son, and the comic sidekick Ronald Weasley in the Harry Potter films. Jeremy, he is heartbreaking in this movie.
Oh, he's wonderful. I've always felt he was a wonderfully natural actor, even seeing him in Harry Potter. And he carries the movie. It's his story.
In one scene, he reads a poem to Sarah, a girl from his religious classes. He has a crush on her. Let's listen.
I do not sing for you, do not fly for you. I am not water, I am not wheat. I would be dove, I would be hawk. Your milky breasts, my strange meat. What do you think?
I'm sorry, but you're just too weird.
Well, just too weird. I mean, is this reflecting your adolescence as well, Jeremy Brock?
I'm ashamed to say I was a bit of a poet monkey. I did write some pretty odd poems. It was an expression of my zeal and my excitement about life. It's just I needed someone to nurture me and give me the confidence to grow up a little bit, which is what Evie does with Ben.
And was it what Dame Ashcroft did with you?
It was what Dame Peggy Ashcroft did for me, although the love story wasn't reciprocal as it is in this movie. She did make me feel like it was okay to say I want to be a writer.
Well, eventually, Evie, your stand-in for Dame Peggy Ashcroft, pulls Ben into a huge adventure that involves camping equipment and driving, which he doesn't know how to do yet. And I don't want to give away the ending, but I have to ask you, knowing your background, there's an unfortunate accident involving,
yes,
Ben's mother. Let's just put it that way.
Quite.
Are we seeing Jeremy Brock, you know, I don't know, wreak some vengeance on his mother in his new movie?
I hope not, but you are seeing Jeremy Brock do some pretty expensive therapy.
By making a film. Julie Walters, one last question to you. Are you a dame yet?
No, I'm not a dame.
She blooming should
not
be.
Yeah.
She should be.
That's star Julie Walters and writer-director Jeremy Brock of the film Driving Lessons, out on DVD today. Well, the last word today goes to another great lady of the arts, Beverly Sills, the Brooklyn girl who became an opera star. Here she is in the role she considered her greatest artistic achievement, Queen Elizabeth I in Donizetti's Roberto Devereux. Beverly Sills also became a leader in the arts community and an advocate for people with disabilities. She died last night at 78, leaving two stepchildren, a son who was autistic, and a daughter who was deaf and never heard her mother sing, but felt the applause. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.